The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, we have a lot of issues to discuss. In our issue segment that I'll be asking you to call in and share your points of view, a commentary from Ralph Nader, Waging Another Unconstitutional War. Then Martha Rosenberg, Selling Depression, Adding a New Spin to Depression Drug Sales, from Counterpunch. So those will be our two issues. You can take on either one. They're both short, but very important. My guest today will continue with our conversations with remarkable minds. It'll be a longer one than normal. And he is Professor Henry Giroux. He holds the Global Television Network Chair of English and Cultural Studies, McMaster's University. He also was previously a Waterbury Chair, Professor at Penn State University. And we're going to talk about America, a land of zombie politics, economics, and culture, how we died and are walking around consuming everything, appreciating nothing. You won't want to miss that. Now, the latest on health and healing in a moment, but upcoming programs, this is just a little preview this week alone. Tomorrow, with a rapid increase in huge investments being made in the genomic sciences, they're trying to sell you that there is a genetic cause for just about everything from suicidal tendencies to obesity, from autism to a wide range of diseases, and even for behavioral traits like if you're cruel or you cheat on your partner. All of those, they're telling us, are in our genes. And of course, then they're going to give us a drug that will correct that. We've been ignoring the fundamental flaws and effects of why genes have changed in the first place. And this has given rise to a parallel science of epigenetics that confronts the older determinist reductionist view of DNA that dominates medical research today. So we're going to talk with Richard Francis about some of the most intriguing and cutting-edge discoveries in the new field of epigenetics, which says our environment and external world have a fundamental role in the genetic changes taking place in our body, but also how the quality of your relationship, who you're with in your life, at work and at home and friends, also can directly impact your genes. How do people speak with you? Do you feel confidence and trust and warmth and love? Do you feel excitement and passion? Or is there any feeling of hesitation, uncertainty? Have you been abused verbally or in writing or emails or in any way by your partner or family members or friends or coworkers? That also can impact your genes. So that's a very important program tomorrow. It'll take the better part of the hour. The next day, has science really explained reality and the world we live in? Are all the claims being made by those most entrenched and dominant scientific communities, especially medicine and physics, behind life on the planet truly conveying reality? And are their solutions based upon scientific fact? Or are all these scientific theories simply subjective ideologies? We'll have Matthew Silverstone, a very unique scientist from Britain, who's the author of Blinded by Science. And we'll talk about the evidence that the way we conventionally see the world through the dominant scientific paradigms is having a serious detrimental effect on our health and our perceptions of the earth and how we interact with it. And then the next day, we hear much about the challenges and crisis that will affect our water, our soil resources, and our food supply, and changing climate due to global warming. However, there are very few people in the climate change community succinctly address the health risks and crisis that are associated with global warming. Professor Paul Epstein, he He's director at the Center for Health and Global Environment at Harvard Medical School, and he is here to talk about what it really means to us. That is what we have coming at us this week. Always important, relevant to our health and well-being, individually and to the planet. Now let's go to the latest on health and healing information. I will be preparing in the very, very near future a major in-depth original investigative report on the true facts behind what's happening in Japan at the Fukushima plant and to their water, the environment, and to the global currents of water and air and how that's impacting the rest of the world. On the one hand, we've been led to believe in the United States by our White House and EPA, which doesn't do anything without talking orders from the White House, that we don't have to test our dairy or our vegetables or sea vegetables or seafood. First, because it's healthy. That's also true with the Gulf of Mexico now. Don't worry about the oil. It's all gone. The fish are healthy and everything the fish eat is healthy. And radiation, well, under the new laws of Barack Obama, radiation is not allowed to enter the United States. It's bad for our body politic. The media can't handle it. The New York Times would have a hard time challenging it. So quite simply, there is no radiation from Japan that will impact us in any negative way. Except it does, and is, and will. So in an in-depth report, I'm going to share that with you. What I can tell you as of this morning, as of today, I should say, and this is from the Tokyo Electric Power Company, that they're stating 240 times, that's 24,000% more radioactive strontium is now in their immediate seawater and in the samples collected than previously thought. The utility said the strontium, radioactive strontium, was also found in groundwater near the plant's number 2 and 3 reactors. And the government's Nuclear and Industrial Safety Agency said it's the first time that the substance has been found in groundwater. Now, here's what I'm suggesting. Just use common sense. Seawater moves. Everything in the ocean moves. There are currents that go clear around the world. So anything that's going into the ocean off the coast of Japan will circulate throughout the world. Strontium at 24,000% higher than what is considered safe in any food is now in the ocean's food supply. And it's there every single day, 24 hours a day. It doesn't stop. Now, our news cycles in the United States are about 2 weeks. So most people today have forgotten about the earthquake in Haiti and are assuming, I would imagine, that with the billions of dollars, over $14 billion promised, that money has flown in, there's new housing, safer, made to better standards, and that people are now getting food, medical care, especially stopping cholera. None of that is true. It's gotten worse, not better. And none of the money really has gotten there, and the money that has been absorbed by corrupt corporations, foundations, and the gangs that run Haiti. This is an absolute, unequivocal, 100% accurate statement. Anyone who wishes to challenge my knowledge of Haiti, the politics of it, from the president on, we know all about him, and all the aid agencies and how things don't work. Let me just give you an example to show you, because I have eyes and ears. I won't tell you my association, what I do. I'll just say that nothing works in Haiti except corruption. Let's say that you, as a concerned citizen, gave money that went to a foundation to buy food for Haiti. None of that food got the Haitian people. If it did get off the boat, and most of that money is going to go to the salaries of the people in these foundations, then it's immediately taken over by either corrupt governmental agencies, officials, or gangs that have control over corrupt government agencies. Because a corrupt government agent can be shot. Everyone knows where they live. Gangs make sure that they let the government agencies know, we know where you live, we know how many children you have, where they go to school. And so if you do not do what we want, we will simply put a bullet in your brain. And no one will be the wiser, nothing will happen to us, because it's never happened to us. So now, all over Haiti, you have warehouses filled with food and water that is sold on the black market at astronomical prices, all in plain view. So the gangs and corrupt politicians have no problem with food and water. The average person today is grossly malnourished, living in abominable conditions. And all of this after everyone high-fived and patted themselves on the back, look how much we did for Haiti. The trouble is, like all of our disaster release, it's the theory and the effort, but not in the results that matter. There are no good results there. Now, so on one hand, we're told we can eat the fish. You can't. We don't have to worry about the air, the radioactivity in the air. We do. And water will take that pollution everywhere. But it's been polluting nonstop every second, not just at one time. It's not like one burst of radiation went into the water, one burst went into a cloud after the explosion. It's melted down. We were told it didn't melt down. Now it turns out it did melt. It melted through the floor. Now, we knew this, and at some point in the future, I am confident this will come out. American drones photographed into the core and showed that those rods were melted, that there were holes in the floor. But how do you tell that to the people? Because then that means there's nothing that can contain the radiation. See, unlike oil that will reach a certain level, hit something and stick to it, it'll stick to rocks, it'll stick to sand, it'll stick to seaweed, it'll stick to animals. Radiation doesn't stick. It permeates, goes right through rock, steel, lead. It'll go right through sand. It'll go right through clay. And it just keeps going. Then it gets into your aquifer. And then the aquifer feeds other aquifers. Water streams feed into aquifers and feeds into water supplies. And suddenly, lo and behold, gee whiz, we got a whole island that water's polluted. So what do? We first deny it, then we hide it, then we say, well, like the FDA did when we found out how many American people had DDT in them, raise the standard of how much we're allowed to have in us. Well, the FDA raised the standard 5 times for how much DDT was found in people, because the more they tested, the higher the rates were. So suddenly they made a previously toxic amount of DDT completely acceptable. Once you realize how official agencies of government and their official representative institutions lie on a regular basis about everything, then you understand the poor people of Japan are going to end up with the worst epidemic of cancers in world history. Because they're the ones who have to eat the food, drink the water, breathe the air, and live in an environment that is now quickly approaching critical mass, meaning so much pollution, so much radiation has gone into the air, the water, and the soil, that there's nothing can be done to contain it, because it went through the bottom. So even if they encapsulated the top, it wouldn't stop it. Anyhow, because we're right on top of this, and because we have sources at all levels, ours are not coming through vetted American media sources and then passed through official channels. So we're getting the truth on it. What I see, worst case scenario, within 3 years, Japan is simply not able to maintain its population in a standard of living safely. Better, they're able to find places within Japan that the water will not be polluted and they will be able to have some quality of life. That's a really big risk. Next up, the omega-3 fatty acids that I've been telling you to take. Well, the British Journal of Nutrition concludes and says it can help prevent heart attack deaths. Let me read this. It says, the British Journal of Nutrition concludes that consuming moderate amounts of the omega-3 fatty acids is superior to a lower intake for the prevention of sudden cardiac death and fatal coronary events. And that's good. So I'm going to suggest, they're even saying 250 milligrams a day. I'm suggesting 1,500 milligrams a day. So in any case, you can help prevent a heart attack. Now, a very big issue for me in finishing, we're now only maybe 2 months away, three at the most, of finishing post-production on Poverty, Inc., a documentary I've been working on for over 3 years. I've interviewed thousands of individuals. In fact, I'll be interviewing people on the streets in Manhattan on Thursday of this week around the city. I'm going to go to the Lower East Side, up in Harlem. I'm going to go to all five boroughs. And then I'm going to go to Wall Street, Madison Avenue. I'm going to ask the average person, what do you know about how bad it is for people in the United States as far as poverty? And see what their feelings are, what they know. But one thing I can tell you is that everywhere you have poverty, you have higher causes of death. Here's the latest on this. This just came out this morning from the American Journal of Public Health, as published in Science Daily. Quote, how many U.S. deaths are caused by poverty and other social factors? About the same as deaths from heart attack and stroke per year. Whoa. That means that if you're poor this year, you have lower education, you've been a victim of racial segregation, low social support, individually poor, you have income inequality, or you live in an area that is poor, here's the rates of death. About 176,000 people, lower education, 160,000, 133,000, 119,000, 39,000. You're up to over 500,000 people will die in the United States this year because they are poor. This is the first time anyone has presented these figures. Quote, these findings argue for a broader public health conceptualization of the causes of mortality and an expansive policy approach that considers how social factors can be addressed to improve the health of populations. Okay, so let's look at it this way. Today in the United States, more Americans will die from being poor and the consequences of that than any other cause, or equal to heart attack and stroke. Well, we know what happens when a person dies of a heart attack or stroke, or has a heart attack and stroke. They're given care, emergency care. Well, there is no such emergency care for those people who are simply poor. As a result, it's an epidemic of death from being poor. There are no advocates. There's no legislation. There's no help. Which is one of the things I'm showing in the film, that these, and how many people are we talking about? Hardcore, one-third of the entire American population, 100 million people. And in this group, 17 million children. Now, what if all of our politicians in Washington, and all of them, had to show you, including the president, what they've actually done, actually achieved, to mitigate the consequences to these people's health from being poor? You realize that there are none of them that would be able to show you anything. They would say, oh, of course, we're going to have a committee on it. We're going to get a panel together. We're going to get bipartisan. And that's one code word for we're going to have nothing change on this. So I just want you to know that when I do a film like this about Poverty, Inc., I'm showing you a picture that does not exist, a picture most people won't want to see. But when one out of every three Americans is at risk of dying at the same rate as a person with a heart attack or stroke, and the same number will die each year as would have a heart attack or stroke because the consequences of being poor, shouldn't we at some point at least make an effort to change this? So more on this coming up. And finally, I've told you many times about why you get the sunlight, 20 minutes a day. Here's the latest from the journal Infection and Immunity. More evidence that vitamin D boosts the immune response. This was laboratory-grown gingival cells treated with vitamin D boosted their production of endogenous antibiotic and killed more bacteria than untreated cells. In lay language, that just means that the more vitamin D you get to a healthy level, you're less likely to have gum disease, you're more likely to have a stronger immune response. So when your body runs into any infectious agent, you're more likely to be strong enough to withstand that. Oh, and for those of you eating fish, well, pharmaceuticals are in your fish. latest from Natural News, Susan Peterson says, does the fish on your plate, quote, need a drug test? According to a recent report by the U.S. Government Accountability Office, the FDA is not doing enough to ensure that the fish available to American consumers is uncontaminated by antibiotics and other pharmaceuticals. They found that the FDA, quote, lacks procedures, criteria, and standards to see that the fish being sent to U.S. markets are safe. European Union, on the other hand, has a much tougher inspection and regulation system for seafood. Of all the fish consumed in the United States, that's all of it, all your restaurants, 80% are imported. Half of imported fish comes from fish farms. The largest fish farms in the world? China. Whoa. Thailand and Indonesia and Vietnam, Ecuador are right behind. And those are all polluted. Chemicals abound. Fish are drugged. In other words, the vast majority of fish are uninspected, unhealthy, unsupervised. As a result, you're getting pharmaceutical drugs every time you eat a piece of fish. So, farm fish, the worst that you could possibly eat, and that's coming from China. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment. Please stay with us. Welcome all of you. I'm Gary Nall, broadcasting live and video streaming live from our studios in New York City, and we welcome all of you. Our issue of the day, and I'm only going to do one, I'm going to save Ralph Nader's for tomorrow, is from Martha Rosenberg, and I'll quote this, selling depression, adding a new spin to depression drug sales. The discovery that many people with life problems or occasional bad moods would be willingly dosing themselves with antidepressants, sailed the drug industry through the 2000s. A good chunk of the nearly $5 billion a year in direct-to-consumer advertising has been devoted to convincing people they don't have a problem with their job, the economy, or their family. They have depression instead, especially because depression can't be diagnosed from a blood test. Unfortunately, three things dried up the depression gravy train for the drug industry. Blockbusters went off patent and generics took off. Antidepressants were linked with gory and unpredictable violence, and especially in young users, and they didn't even work, according to medical articles. That's when the drug industry began debuting the concept of treatment-resistant depression. It wasn't that the drugs didn't work. You had treatment-resistant depression. Your first expensive and dangerous drug needed to be coupled with more expensive and dangerous drugs because a monotherapy. One drug alone wasn't enough to do the trick. So now they said, oh, did we tell you for the last 40 years that you had to get Paxil, Prozac, and Zoloft, and Effexor, and Valium? No, we got it wrong. Now you have to have three drugs. Of course, this is all hocus pocus. None of it works. But this is what the drug industry is now creating in a campaign to try to float that you need more, because otherwise you're going to be self-limiting the treatment of your disease. So that's what she's saying. Now, of course, because I'm doing a new documentary on this, I'll keep that under wraps, except to tell you we are filming a lot of interesting things. I have a group of psychiatrists, all highly respected, that were filmed undercover in their offices with a completely normal, healthy person. And every single psychiatrist gave a different diagnosis of what this person's mental illness was and immediately prescribed drugs. When later confronted that this was a completely healthy person, it was just sloughed off. Well, you know, it's somewhat subjective. I almost felt like that television show that catches sexual predators going to someone's house. They think they're going to have a young person, and then, gotcha. Well, none of these doctors seemed at all embarrassed that they were making diagnoses were inaccurate and giving drugs the person didn't need. That's all I'm going to say. But you got to see what we did outside the American Psychiatric Society's annual meeting. You talk about holding them to different, to a higher standard. And what was interesting is all the European psychiatrists who came from around the world, they were much more honest. Is there a chemical basis for any psychiatric disorder? Schizophrenia, Alzheimer's, or schizophrenia, bipolar, manic? No. I mean, every single one? No. Is there brain chemical imbalance? Is there any proof of it? No. Well, then what you're doing is just subjectively suggesting that a normal cause of life, something goes wrong, a relationship, lose your job, having problems meeting your budget, now you're making a normal life event into a psychiatric diagnosis. Yeah. No American doctor will be honest. All the European doctors were. And I'm talking about a lot. You'll see it all in the film when it comes out. So here's the question and here's the issue. Every single day on television programs, you're seeing drugs advertised to convince you that you or your children need an antipsychotic or an antidepressant medication, and now multiple ones. And they'll give you the side effects, including suicide, very quickly. At what point as a society do we simply say enough? All you've done in our free market is create the notion that we're crazy, that normal behavior is now a disease that you can profit from. They're supported by Democrats and Republicans alike, equally. They're supported by every single president that I can go back to Eisenhower in the White House. They have all these top former politicians as consultants or lobbyists on their behalf. At what point do we just stand up as Americans and say, you're not going to drug me and you're not going to drug my children? And yeah, life happens, and it always has, and we'll get through it, but not because of your medication. It more likely than not is going to cause one of our children to kill themselves. You'll take no responsibility, or you'll get out of it by saying we can't be sued because you put a black box warning on the side of the label. Your thoughts, 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888, that's our issue of the day. Now, Elizabeth, before we go to our guest, let's take a look at one issue. Take on any issue you'd like.
Okay. We received a letter from a son of a 20-year veteran of the NYPD police. He's writing because he went running in Prospect Park with his dad. They ran the whole park, and just as they finished, his dad said to him, "You'll never know the real truth until you get there." And he said, "What do you mean?" His dad explained he'd been listening to Gary and his show on WMCA from 1976, and what Gary was saying, what you were saying, was so radically different from anything he'd believed in thus far. He said, "Well, what if this man's right?" So he thought he'd try it, and he became a vegan. But he had to keep it quiet because he, amongst the cops who were he was working with, they were all heavy drinking Irishmen like him in the past, and they'd only mock him. So he had, like, heart disease of the liver were normal for those in their 40s and 50s and those in that time. And his dad kept the strict health protocol all these years. He also de-stressed. He read all your articles and he watched lots of your videos. And also, the mother was also on the same protocol. Today, they're filled with joy and happiness. They don't look like the typical 85-year-olds. They look more like they're in their 50s. They have good muscle form. His hair is a natural color. It's as though time has stood still these last 35 years for this man. His dad had said last week that all the papers were now showing that cell phones cause cancer, and it's official. But he was saying to his son there that you had been saying this all these years ago, and everything is everything that's important that they're talking about today, you had spoken of 10, 20, 30 years ago. So he was thinking of all the things, you know, pesticides, corrupt politicians, gold and silver going up, the stock market crashing. You were ahead of the curve on everything. His friends, sadly, they also didn't know the truth of something until they got there in a bad way, because, for example, his brothers have died at 63 and 67, buddies in the New York Police Department are all dead, and therefore, you know, they are the consequences of their choices that have been the accumulated negative effects of their lives and their lifestyles, whereas the father is now the manifestation of the accumulation of all his positive choices. His father's looking forward to a creative and dynamic future. He wants to go to Ireland to work on his own homesteading project, go back to Ireland. Their kitchen looks like a health food store. They sprout in it. They have a garden in the backyard. They're seen as eccentric by their neighbours, but, you know, they know that they're right. So this man was just saying that driving home from the park, after having this conversation with his dad, he realised he'd taken so much information for granted. And the father, you know, was saying that you just don't know the truth until you get to your location. That's what he meant.
Well, first, how many people could go for a run around Prospect Park with an 85-year-old father or mother?
Yeah.
That tells you something. I like what the father said. You'll never know the truth of something till you get to your destination. How many times have we believed that someone was telling us the truth, and then when we got to where we could test it, verify it was not true? Women were told to smoke because it would calm their nerves, and that was promoted by doctors in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Their destination was lung cancer, heart attack, and stroke. My mother was one. My father was one. My older brother was one. My aunts and uncles, over 20, were ones. We didn't want women to do a marathon. We said it was not physiologically possible. It would strain their body. They were not anatomically able to do it. It turns out women are better able to do a marathon than men because of a high percentage of body fat and releasing that during a race, etc. They were all wrong. The doctors were the experts. But you wouldn't know that until you didn't exercise, because women weren't supposed to exercise. When my mother stopped exercising, I asked her, why are you not exercising? She said, well, it doesn't look right. I said, what do you care what it looks like? Well, you know, I don't want to be the only person who's doing something and no one else is. I said, yeah, but look at them, Mom. They're all overweight and, you know, they got high blood pressure and diabetes. She said, I know, but you want to fit in, Gary. I said, I don't want to fit in anywhere. You know, but that's the idea. So now let's just examine for a second. So one day you wake up and you realize that your political beliefs, that we have to waterboard people to get the truth, and that's the only way we were able to get Osama bin Laden, it's a lie, but that's what your belief is. And that there's no other way of getting the truth, that we need to give money to those who are most powerful and wealthy, and if a bank fails, we have to help them out, and the very bank that's going to throw you out on on the street with your family without any concern, you've got to protect its interests. We don't want it to fail, no matter how corrupt it is, no matter how greedy it is. You won't know that what you're doing or the politicians doing on your behalf is wrong till you get there. Well, now we're there. On every level, our educational system, which are trying to privatize and corporatize, our prison system, the war on cancer, the war on drugs, the war on poverty, the war on terror, all of these are wrong. And we're there. So do we have the courage to change the direction? That man who spent his last 35 years living a different lifestyle than his family and friends and society, now at 85 is able to be healthy because his truth was discovered by being there today. How often do we look ahead to say, what is the likely truth of my actions in the future? Thank you very much, Elizabeth. Now let's go over. My guest is standing by. We got him on the phone. Let's say hello to Professor Henry Giroux. He holds the Global Television Network Chair of English and Cultural Studies at McMaster's University in Ontario, Canada. He was previously the Waterbury Chair Professor at Penn State University and Director of the Forum in Education and Cultural Studies. Now, Professor Giroux is a leader in the field known as critical and public understanding, a term to describe the nature of spectacle in our new media and body politic and corporate education. And he's a prominent advocate for radical democracy, which opposes the powers of neoliberalism and corporatism and religious fundamentalism that is now so pervasive in our society. He's the author of a new book, which I was reading yesterday, the advance on. It's called Zombie Politics and the Culture of the Age of Casino Capitalism. Nice to have you with us today.
Hi, Gary. How are you? Good to be here.
Thank you. I'm going to just give you a whole opening here, and where you can take it is up to you. Let's speak on what you call zombie politics and culture, which you refer to as a new and unique form of social existence that has emerged in America, whereby the political culture empowers work in mutual interest solely for the bare survival and disposability of civilians, citizens. And this in turn is leading to a nation built upon social death, as you call it, and a new authoritarianism. So what do you see as the strongest relationship between zombie politics and free market fundamentalism? Could you answer those?
I think that one basically feeds the other. I think that one of the things that I try to argue in the book, without sort of exaggerating the cartoonish nature of the term, is that this concept of zombies really points to the merger of what I call a form of casino capitalism and the punishing state. And what that means is that as the social state is completely deracinated and largely undermined by corporate sovereignty and power, increasingly what we have in the United States is the emergence of a formative culture that really is based on not only producing the misfortune of others, but actually taking delight in the misfortune of others. And so you have this increasing logic of statism and violence and militarism that permeates the culture in ways in which it actually feeds not only on misfortune, but takes delight in it. And I think that one of the things that I had tried, that I try to say in the book that I think is really quite crucial is that all of a sudden we find ourselves in a culture in which brutality has now eclipsed the possibility for social compassion and social responsibility. We no longer have a language for talking about democracy. We no longer have a language for talking about community and social justice. All of these, in some way, are seen basically as either a pathology or as a failure. And I think that that's not to say that there aren't people who are struggling for those terms and struggling against the policies that undermine questions of democracy and justice. But at almost every platform, every plateau, every instance of where corporate power works on the culture and on the society, you have a death machine at work. You have a political machine that basically cares almost nothing about workers, cares nothing about youth. All it basically cares about is the bottom line. And it basically, what it does is it converges around questions of power and money and politics and education, a kind of public pedagogy that increasingly tells people they're alone, everything should be privatized, we should collapse the public into the private, and that basically anybody who is dependent upon anybody else is somehow a parasite. So it really does mark a turn away from the social state, away from the language of compassion and social responsibility, into a place that is very unlike anything we've seen before. I mean, into a place where a kind of economic Darwinism really seems to have sway, a terrific amount of influence and sway over the culture.
I appreciate that answer. By the way, virtually all of our presidents from Reagan forward have participated in this, as well as Margaret Thatcher and Tony Blair, as well as Merkel in Germany, and other national heads. They've supported.
This is what is so dangerous about this. I mean, what's so dangerous is that this zombie politics, this culture of cruelty and the corporatism that it basically reproduces, it cuts across ideological lines. I mean, it's really what we can say that the Republicans represent the most extreme moment of this. I mean, all you have to do is look at Obama, and it becomes clear that Obama and Clinton and others have participated in this, as well as a number of Democrats, in ways that suggest the two-party system clearly is dead. I mean, they're both zombies. I mean, they're zombie parties. They're really concerned about the survival of corporate power and financial institutions, and to say the very least, the ultra-rich. They have really no interest whatsoever in those people who constitute what a real democracy is. Those 99% who really now have no representation in the United States.
Let me share one thought. I believe that people such as Ron Paul, who would get us out of our wars, but I believe that that there has to be a humanist, spiritual, type of libertarianism, and that libertarianism is in its current form is actually anti-popular. Anti-populism. I also believe that the Tea Party, contradicting everything that we've been taught, is actually anti-populism, because I believe that there is a disconnect between populism as it's being preached and true democracy. And so therefore, if we were able to have truly a true democratic populist understanding, it would be completely different than our need to get enough capital to run out so we can buy something and we can continue at the mall, and then we look at life as obsolescence. Okay, we've used it, throw away. Why do you need to buy all that stuff? Where's it been going when you throw it away? It's ending up in places that are not sustainable. I don't care. That's not my business. Your thoughts on this whole idea that we have, or do you believe that, if you don't, please challenge me on it, that our current concept of populism is really anti-democratic?
I don't think populism has many strains. And I think that what you're talking about, and I completely agree with, actually, is that this is right-wing populism. I mean, and what this is a celebration of atomization and privatization and individualism in ways that free people from any democratic notion of the social. I don't see how you can talk about freedom without allowing the notion of individual freedom to be connected somehow with the question of social rights, meaning that being an individual and having the kind of private and political freedoms that which often boil down to a freedom from constraint really means anything unless people have a certain amount of economic rights. If people don't have jobs, if people don't have health care, if people don't engage in social relationships in which they recognize their dependency on each other, that call to freedom is really quite hollow, because it basically is rooted in terrible and harmful forms of inequality that give rise to all kinds of modes of authoritarianism and fundamentalism. So to talk about freedom as simply the freedom from constraint is really to talk about a notion of freedom rooted in a kind of narcissism and self-interest that actually undermines any viable notion of democracy. The real question here is, if populism is going to be taken seriously, it has to reinvent the notion of the social. It has to recognize that basically you have to have a social fabric in which there are protections, in which there are government responsibilities, in which there are constraints around major power, in which the capacities and the institutions that enable a democracy to deepen and flourish will actually be reproduced. That's hard work. And that's not about a mode of populism that basically is all about simply narrating its own self-interest as consumers.
I appreciate that. Thank you. For those listening on our land-based stations around the United States, you're going to be coming to a conclusion here in a moment. My guest, Professor Henry Giroux, that's G-I-R-O-U-X, author of Zombie Politics, will continue. We'll continue this dialogue right now live over the Internet on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. That's ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. If you forget that, go to GaryNall.com. Now, that said, at what point does free market corporate culture and a politics devoted to that culture become authoritarian? I'm seeing more and more of what goes on in America as creeping totalitarianism with high levels of fascist input. And can we now say with any certainty that free market capitalism, in particular casino capitalism, which dominates Wall Street and the policy decision making in Washington, is compatible with democracy and the higher ideals of freedom and liberty that democracy is built upon?
No, not at all. I actually think that, without being too extreme here, I actually think that that mode of capitalism, that mode of market fundamentalism, or let's call it what it should be called, casino capitalism and economic Darwinism, it actually views democracy as a deficit. I mean, it has no interest in questions of equality, in questions of social justice, in questions of creating a formative culture in which people actually have the opportunities and the capacities to learn how to govern rather than simply be governed. And I think all you have to do is look around, and you know this as much as anyone. I mean, you can't talk about a democracy that basically supports a torture state. You can't talk about a democracy that tramples on civil liberties. You can't talk about a democracy that lies to its people, which has a government that lies to its people and produces unjust wars, that gives trillions away through basically in tax cuts to the rich while making a claim for what I call deficit porn, which is really not about an economic deficit. It's about a deficit in morality. I think you can't talk about a democracy or a government that makes a claim to democracy that makes no social investments in its youth, that produces a culture of cruelty and destroys all things public. That's the antithesis of democracy. That's a new form of authoritarianism. We don't have the Hitler figure in the boots and all of that. What we have is we have a form of political sovereignty ruled by the state, or the social state, or the democratic state, now being replaced by a form of corporate sovereignty. It has no interest in ethics. It has no interest in social justice, and it has no interest in social responsibility. All it has is an interest in basically the bottom line. It's ruthless, it's cruel, and it's the farthest thing from democracy that one can imagine.
How is it that anyone can take any politician seriously today, particularly towards anything they say regarding redeeming social values, when they are all fused at the hip with the corporate culture and interests?
I think that's the most important question you've asked, and I think it's important because it raises the issue, how is it that people can actually begin to participate in modes of domination of which they're the victims? And I think the question here, the issue here, is that we have to understand how the educational force of the culture has now exercises such an enormous influence over the way in which people think and act. We haven't seen anything like this. In really throughout history. I mean, we had educational institutions that were basically restricted to the family, you know, to basically the schools. But now we have what C. Wright Mills called a cultural apparatus that is so in the hands of very few rich and powerful people. Fox News, Pravda News, so to speak. I mean, that basically have so limited the choices, the worldviews, the frames of references that people have, that it becomes very difficult to rupture these kinds of ideologies. It becomes very difficult to understand how they might be contradicted. They become normalized. So people don't talk, when people talk about democracy or citizenship, they think you're talking about consumerism, the freedom to buy. Or when people talk about democracy, they think it means that we live in a world in which is basically inhabited by middle-class people, and we don't have a punishing state, and we don't put, you know, we don't fill the prisons with 70% of people who are in color, and we don't privatize schools. And so the question has to become, you know, what is it that we can do to rupture this normalized view of the world that basically privileges corporations and the ultra-rich? Now you know and I know that the ultra-rich, now they're very aware of how powerful culture is. I mean, all you have to look is the Koch brothers. All you have to look is the variety of what do you call these things, these various institutes that now are being basically produced by right-wing corporations and rich right-wing individuals.
Bordellos, that's what they're called.
They're called what?
Bordellos.
Yeah, bordellos. They are bordellos. They're intellectual bordellos. And what they have now created are like an army of anti-public intellectuals. An army. They're everywhere. They appear on talk shows. They appear on the radio. And basically their theme is always the same. And that is, if it's public, it's a pathology. If it has anything to do with social guarantees, it means it's parasitic. And it goes on and on. I mean, and they simply believe that economics drives politics and that money markets set policies. I mean, that's the logic. And so there are no short, there are no long-term goals. There are no social investments. There are only short-term goals to basically enrich the lives of private individuals and corporations. And I think that until we take this question of culture on the progressives, take this question of education seriously and what it means, we're in big trouble.
Final two questions. In the past, you've written extensively about the commodification of our children and youth, particularly within our empire of consumption. And we hear from the GOP as well as the Obama White House now that universal health care is just socialism to be avoided. But now we are led to believe that even public education is another side of the demon of socialization, and therefore education should be privatized and turned over to the corporations as another commodity to consume. And as you say, the current market economics makes education undemocratic and is another step towards commodifying the public sphere. So how do you relate this to the growing disparity between social classes, the loss of democratic principles, the dumbing down of ever larger segments of our population? And where do you see this ultimately leading and for whose benefit?
Well, I think that the Obama administration is far worse than the Bush administration around educational policy for all the reasons that you've given. I mean, their notion of educational reform and their allegiance with and to the billionaires club, whether it be Bill Gates or a whole range of the DeVos family, a whole range of other people, it's basically, you're right, about privatizing education. I mean, they view education as basically a source of two things, either training people to be workers in a very limited, narrow sense, or basically defunding and depoliticizing schools so that they do not provide individuals with the possibility for being reared in a culture of questioning, one in which dissent, engagement, thoughtfulness, dialogue, all the things that make citizens operative can become possible. So you have a dual attack here. You have an attack on the notion of public schools as a public good, as democratic public spheres, and you have a notion, an attack on the public school as basically a place where people can make power accountable. And so it feeds very well into a kind of political system in which it becomes impossible for people any longer to be in schools and sort of find themselves in places where, you know, in a public sphere where there are remnants of what it means to learn how to think. I mean, I think the message that Obama sends people in the United States about schooling is that thinking is an act of stupidity and shouldn't be tolerated, and that we should implement policies and practices precisely for that reason.
Final question. On America's growing society of cruelty, and since 9/11, our aggressive foreign policies and scandals over torture and the killing of thousands of civilians throughout the world as simply collateral damage has created a body politic that is based on violence and cruelty. At the same time, we witness the level of violent images increasing across our entertainment media, including the right-wing news media and its talking heads like Glenn Beck and Michael Savage and Limbaugh. If this is a concerted strategy being implemented by right-wing groups and media, what do you perceive its ultimate goal is regarding the kind of public these groups want to shape?
I'll tell you, I think we got a glimpse of it recently, Gary, with the kill team photos in Afghanistan. I mean, as bad as the Abu Ghraib photos were, in which people seem to take a certain pleasure in torturing people, what we now have with the kill team photos is an indication of an economy of pleasure in which a pleasure in violence now translates into a pleasure into actually killing people. And it seems to me that this pleasure is no longer simply a matter of individual pathology as we were led to believe about Abu Ghraib, but now is actually a social pathology. And I think that where it goes, and I may be wrong on this, and maybe this is a leap, but I have a feeling I'm right, and that is where it goes is it increasingly legitimates policies in which punishment becomes the only modality for really being able to deal with social problems. I mean, we have a book that was just written about a guy called In Defense of Flogging in the United States. You probably heard about this.
Yes.
In which this guy claims that what we should do to reform the prison system is we should give prisoners the choice between taking their sentences or getting flogged. Public flogging for every year that they have to serve. I mean, this is mind-blowing. I mean, I think that when these kinds of discourses emerge in which you merge the spectacle of violence with the pleasure of sadism, you finally had arrived at a place where the punishing state becomes the only option to dealing with social problems. People are homeless, we beat them in public. We have bum video TVs. People can't pay their mortgages, we put them on a reality TV show and we dehumanize them. People don't look good, they're overweight, they have diabetes for all the reasons you mentioned with the last guest. We make a spectacle out of them. We invent something called poverty porn, in which we blame the poor, we blame misfortune on the victims, and then we turn it into something that can be celebrated. It's sort of like economic Darwinism transforming itself into a reality TV show in which the biggest spectacle of all is watching the suffering of others. If we begin to believe this, if that's all that's left, if that's the only outlet for pleasure that's left, then it seems to me that the punishing state is won. and the social state has collapsed. Now, I say that, but I want to end here. I also want to say why all of this, I think, is basically true as an argument. At the same time, these struggles are incomplete. There's alternative media. There's your program. There are groups all over the country struggling, those somewhat at a liability at the moment, given the current regime of political power. But these struggles are ongoing. How might I say this? This form of domination is not accomplished. They haven't won. It hasn't ended. And so we want to hope that we can learn as much as we can from these struggles, figure out what kind of transformations have been made ideologically, politically, institutionally, and educationally, and begin to invent a new kind of politics that makes these struggles even more successful.
I agree with that. Thank you very much for being with us today and sharing your insights with us.
Okay, Gary, thank you.
Professor Henry Giroux.com. Just go to Henry A. Giroux.com, G-I-R-O-U-X, author of Zombie Politics. I'm Gary Nall. I want to thank you all for staying with us and listening to this program. I look forward to sharing more with you on tomorrow's show. Now, coming up, we have Ellen, who is here with The Natural Nurse, and she'll be starting her show and her guest. And also, for those of you who I didn't get to on the call today because we ran a little late, I'll get to you tomorrow. 7 p.m. today, a brand new program I'm doing only on commentaries on socially relevant issues. Have a nice day, everyone.
Gary Nall Show is produced in our New York City studio. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. The chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Jason Taubenfeld. Your home, done lost your woman and everything you own. All that is blame, it states that chances go around.